Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help.
Hello, friends, and welcome to what I promise will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. So glad you are with us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the stage. And across the way, George P. Fraser, two men who are uniquely unqualified for most jobs. How are you, George?
I think we are unqualified for most jobs.
Trust me, we are.
Congratulations on your job.
Oh, thanks, George. You mean the daytime job, the real job?
Yeah, it's never too late to get a real job.
It is not. I couldn't be happier.
And you're doing a great job.
Why, thank you.
I listened to the podcast way too early to get up and catch it in real time.
Thank you, yes. All right, George, I want to open a little scripture tonight. I'm in Proverbs 27 tonight. Verse 12, the prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep going and suffer for it. I don't know what that means.
I can attest to both of those.
Yeah. The prudent see danger and take refuge, and the simple keep going and suffer for it.
Well, I would take that, Bill, like the mocker and the fool in the early parts of Proverbs. I heard you give a sermon on that down at the Salvation Army one night.
Oh, yeah.
That the mocker does not take instruction. That would be that guy.
Exactly. And then in Proverbs 19:3, one of our favorite verses on the show, and George, you know that one as well, a man's own folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against the Lord.
I love that.
I do too.
Here, I'm going my own way, and I want your support, God, and when things don't work out, I'm mad at you.
Yes, you blow up your own life, and then you're mad at God. Go figure.
Yep, and it happens a lot. There's also people that become Christians in the hope that I got Jesus on my side, I'm going to get what I want, and then when they don't get it, they walk away.
I agree.
A little prosperity gospel there. Don't leave me hanging, brother.
I paused there for a minute. Yeah. So what I'm saying is tonight, if you are in a place where you've maybe blown up parts of your life, and maybe you're feeling mad at God, we're here for you tonight. We're going to talk about this. We're going to give you some hope, because our in-studio guests, we've got Ted and Sarah here, a mother and son. This is going to be one of the great episodes of Real Recovery history.
Oh, it'll be better than that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think there are a lot of great episodes in Real Recovery. You know, one of the miracles is we're still on, and it's fun to do.
Well, the first 3 years, we weren't actually plugged in. The microphones were not plugged in.
Really?
Yes, we've been on the air a couple of years.
I feel kind of hurt by that.
Don't take it personally.
Okay.
Yeah, this is good.
What I like about tonight, we were talking before the show, we got both ends of the recovery here, because most of the time we talk about somebody who is either the star of the recovery or the star of a family in recovery. And usually the person who's the star of the family in recovery, the person didn't make it who was in recovery.
Right.
Tonight we got a win-win, and I'm really looking forward to it. I don't have an expertise in Al-Anon and how to support people. I do in helping people get sober, so it's going to be great to hear from an expert tonight on this. And offer information, Bill. We get asked all the time, what can I do to help my kid? Because when you're in that position, you feel helpless, hopeless, and a lot of times it doesn't end well. And tonight it did. And I'm real encouraged by that, so I really thank you guys for doing the show.
We'll bring them on, time permitting.
If we get off a roll.
Yeah.
Be ready.
And one of our guests tonight is an author. She's written a book called Just Keep Going, Parents. So parents, you're going to want to listen up tonight, especially if you are in this position where you are dealing with a child that is struggling with addiction. And she is going to be a tremendous source of encouragement and comfort. And you're going to feel like you've got a best friend sitting next to you tonight. It's going to be great.
I kind of felt that way.
You
usually
do.
I look like I feel like I have an adversary across from me. So tonight's better. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk, George, about steps tonight, because on Real Recovery, if you are just starting to listen to the program, thank you. And then also understand that we talk about the highest power being Jesus, but we also talk about the power of the steps. And we try to cover at least one or two an episode.
Yeah, and I look at the steps as kind of Christianity 101 for dummies, in that for me, it's how I walk out my faith. There's a Fidelity investment commercial that gives a green path for following your investments. That's how I look at the 12 steps. Philippians 2:12, I think it is. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Don't look it up unless it verifies. But that's what we're looking at. And tonight we're looking at steps 8 and 9. Step eight is we made a list of all people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And step nine is we make amends to them all, except where to do so would injure them or others. I want to break that down a little bit. We want to write down all the people we have harmed, and you can basically look at step four and get a really good, almost a complete look at that, and then become willing to make amends. What are amends? Okay, you got forgiveness in step five, and one of the reasons it's so important to have Jesus as your higher power, he is the highest power, is no one else can forgive your sins. And step five isn't about feeling good about yourself because you've cleansed your conscience. It's about getting forgiveness of sins. That's where it came from, the Oxford group.
Mm-hmm.
So you come out of that and you do feel better, but you also have, if you have Christ, forgiveness of sins. You have eternal life. It's a big deal. If you don't have Jesus, leaving a lot on the table there.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to eight and nine and you're ready to do your part. And I'm not coming to you for your forgiveness. I'm coming to you to let you know that I'm sorry and what can I do about it. When I do eight and nine, I'm looking at all the people I've harmed. I'm being willing to make amends. And you're going to get rejected possibly on this, but you already have forgiveness from Jesus. So you can walk in like a man and walk out like a man. You've done your part. It's always nice when we get somebody to say, I'll do whatever you can. And, you know, mostly that's what happens. Almost everybody I went to said, I'm glad you're finally doing something about it. It's not going to be a shock to people that you have a problem, okay? But sometimes you might get the cold shoulder and somebody might say, well, I need some proof. Okay, I guess in my Bible, I'm not forgiven if I don't forgive people. And so if I got to wait and see proof on what you do, that's not really forgiveness. And so for me, if you're listening and you're on the other end of that, you might want to pray to God for the ability to forgive, however the outcome. But if somebody wants to make it right to you, take it. And I don't think I would negotiate down. I would be honest and go, this is what it is. And if I'm looking at Ted and I say, I owe you $500, but you know what, Ted? All I can give you is five a week. That's what you do, and that's what you take. You know, we want to hold people accountable, but we also want to make it doable.
What are you doing borrowing $500 from Ted?
Well, you won't give me any more.
Oh, no, I've cut you off.
You know,
for a good reason.
Well, I can tell by the clothes. Yeah. Yeah. No, does that make sense to you, though, that you want to go out and not just do mouth service? If you
right.
owe money, you got to pay it back.
But you want to make amends, right?
The other thing is if you broke the law, you might have to look at doing some time here. But here's what I want to tell you. From my experience, Bill, people who didn't do this completely did not stay sober because I have a secret. I had a relapse dream last night. I haven't had one of these in 5 years. And I woke up this morning and I thought, oh, my gosh, I actually used. Because that's how you feel for about 2 minutes when you wake up. And then I realized I didn't really do it, and it was great. And I realized I would rather have cancer and be sober than not have cancer and relapsed.
Hmm.
And that's interesting to me. I don't know what that thought is, but it.
And just for our listeners, let our listeners know you do have cancer.
Yes.
I mean,
I didn't relapse. Let's let them know
that.
No,
I know, but I mean, yeah. When you make a comment like that, it sounds kind of drastic. But for listeners who might not know, you do have cancer, and actually, you had a stage 4 cancer. Which is about as serious as it gets.
Well, there's stage 5, and that's home with Jesus. So,
that's
yeah,
true.
Well,
that's true.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. And then through a lot of good drugs and doctors and really through the power of prayer, you have been downgraded to stage 1, which is just, I've never even heard of that.
No, I haven't either. I've been downgraded a lot in my life, but this is the first good time. You know, we don't have a George Fraser Recovery Cancer Fund.
Nor are we going to start one?
Okay, I thought that might have come from God right there, but apparently it didn't. It came from me.
Yeah.
But no, and I think our sobriety, we have to be willing to go to any lengths. And what we're looking at, what we're going to hear tonight, is a guy who has done that, who got sober at an early age, at 20. That doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
It's real hard to do that because all your buddies are still using. Very few people get sober at that age. So it's going to be a great show.
It is. And then when I was reading the start of Sarah's book, which is called Just Keep Going, Parents. And she talks about on summer evenings, kind of like a night like this, lacing up her walking shoes, grabbing her music and headphones and some tissues and setting out in the darkness in the neighborhood to pray, to cry and to mourn and to beg God for help. as she watched one of her three sons spiral down through his teenage years in a distress that she could have never imagined. And we actually have that son in studio tonight. We're going to hear his story when we come back from the break. And then we're going to hear Sarah's side of it, too. It's going to be a great show, George.
Absolutely.
So thanks for listening to Real Recovery. We are so glad you're with us tonight. And we will take a very short break and be right back.
Seems I've got to have a chance to see you.
All right, welcome back to Real Recovery. Glad you're with us tonight. Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Alex W. at the board. And Sarah is our guest in studio with her son, Ted. And she's written a book called Just Keep Going, Parents. And it was spiritual encouragement from the mom of a troubled teen. And we have that troubled teen sitting to my left. His name is Ted. Hello, Ted.
Hello. Thanks for having us on the show.
You bet. So you were a troubled teen, huh?
I was quite troubled. Yeah. No longer, though.
No longer.
Well, no longer a teen, no longer troubled.
Well, we need more show to fill, so. Hopefully there's,
the cliff notes,
there's
all
more,
right.
more details than just that.
I'll give you a little more.
Okay.
Should I take it from the beginning?
Yeah. How did you get involved what is it, rebellion? Is that the word?
That's one way to put it.
Okay.
Well, I grew up in southern Wisconsin and grew up in a really great home. My parents have now and have always had a strong marriage, and I have two brothers, and we were all close growing up. So it was a wonderful childhood and no complaints there. When I was about 12, some things changed within a year. A number of people in my life who were close to me passed away, which is part of life, experiencing death. But it was my best friend who lived across the street. His name was Tim. Another very good friend who also happened to be named Teddy. Both died within a few months. A mentor who was in my life passed away, and then a grandparent. So it was a lot in one year. And if I would attribute the onset of drug experimentation to anything, it probably would be that. Although I think, frankly, it would have been inevitable at some point. Based on what I know about myself now. But I went out and I looked for it. I looked for drugs. I knew a couple people who, even at that early age, had started smoking marijuana. And
how old?
Maybe 12 or 13.
Okay.
So I looked for it, and I found it, and I liked it. So pretty much right out of the gate, it became a habit of mine, something that I did regularly. I liked maximizing pleasure and escaping pain. And a number of my friends.
Have you met George?
Yeah, we have some common ground.
I liked him when he came in.
I know
he's
did.
Got some potential.
Yeah. Were you a weed person at 12 or 13?
No.
Okay.
15. But
15.
It's one of the gateway drugs. Okay. And of course, nicotine maybe have preceded that. I don't know in your case. But yeah, very common. He's a lot younger, so the age of entry has gotten earlier and earlier as the generations pass. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, tobacco was a part of that too, and always has been. Yeah, I did start in terms of being termed a rebellious teen. I was getting in trouble pretty regularly, and things on the home front all was not well. So
have you met George?
How are your grades?
I passed most classes.
So they're adequate.
They
weren't great. Everybody get you off your back then?
Yeah. Well, I was lying about where I was. I was stealing money out of my mom's purse every day of the week. And I was coming home late and sneaking out in the middle of the night and smoking pot in my room and having women over when I shouldn't and getting into fights and pretty much anything that we could think of to stir a little trouble. So. And I, at this time, was going through pretty serious depression, was emotionally unstable, to say the least, and was just having a hard time making my way through life, which I think in some ways is a typical teenager, but maybe heightened.
Yeah, were you going to church at this time?
Yeah, we were. I was raised in a Christian home, and my parents have always been strong believers, and I think in a really practical way too. So they encouraged that in our home, and we had to go to church, but it wasn't shoved down our throats in a way where, oh, we have this bad taste in our mouths about Christianity and it's forced upon us.
It wasn't necessarily boring, was it? Did you find church?
Well, I didn't find it to be wildly entertaining, and I didn't love...
That was kind. That was very kind. Good for you. See, for Bill at 13, that was the highlight of his week.
I couldn't wait.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Really? Well...
Different churches.
I guess
I'm sure.
And I have less in common.
Though. We do. We have less in
different
common.
Different churches.
Yeah.
So, you never left the prayer list, so I'm going to guess, and we'll confirm that when your mom gets on, but I bet there were a lot of people praying for you this whole time.
Yeah, there always have been. We've always had a lot of people, on my team and thinking about me and praying for me for a lot of years. So.
Did you know you were goofing up here? Was there a part of you going, I'm not doing the right thing, or did you just having too much fun to care?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There was fun being had, but life was not a party in that it was blissful and all we were doing was smiling and laughing. I was not happy.
Okay.
And was not well. So there were moments of euphoria for sure, but those were like synthetic moments that were not genuine and they were fleeting at best. So I think it was pretty evident to people around me that something was not right.
Okay, so you're smoking pot. You're doing a little drinking too?
I actually didn't drink much until I got to college because I liked feeling in control. I liked having a way out, so I liked being able to drive, and I just preferred a sort of mellow high rather than what I saw people doing drinking, which seemed a little crazier.
So through high school, just pot, no White Cross, no downers?
No. There was, in recovery, termed myself a garbage can. So back in the day, I would take anything. I'd take birth control if it would get me a little buzz going, so...
I have not heard that one does.
But, well, so I don't think I actually did, but anything I could get my hands of that would alter my state of mind, I would say. I was buying pills off anybody I could, and everybody has an Adderall prescription, it seems, so, and many of them were happy to sell it to me. Cocaine, hallucinogens, whatever it may. I'd take 20 Tylenol on a day where I couldn't find anything else.
Okay, so at what point did it go from pot to where I got to get high as much as I can? And I'll do whatever I can to do it. How quickly did that progress?
I think it was almost immediate. I don't remember ever being a moderate user of anything. So I remember the first time I smoked pot, and I don't remember a moment where I thought, well, I'll be doing this every moment of my life from henceforth. But I'm just not the kind of guy where if it feels good, I'm interested in moderation. So... It became habitual right away.
So you're an all-in guy.
I'm an all-in guy, which has been a great personality trait at times, and at other times, a very dangerous one.
I gotcha. And I don't want to narc you out here in front of your mom. I'm assuming she knows the whole story.
She knows.
So very quickly, you're a full-time party guy. And yet you're holding it together because I'm assuming you graduated from high school because you said you went to college. So did you have pretty decent grades?
No, I had decent grades. There were one or two classes that I struggled to pass because I had a lack of interest. But I could do well in school when I wanted to do well in school. And I could charm teachers, and teachers liked me because I was smart. But I just didn't care about doing the homework and didn't care to show up to class too often. But I was on the tennis team and I was on other athletic teams and I went to school and I had a million friends. So I wasn't completely despondent or disassociated with school. I just cared less about grades than I did about other things.
Any legal problems in high school?
No, I really did. I've just been so fortunate that for whatever reason, God's protected me from legal repercussions because there's a lot of law breaking going on, but that's just not part of my story.
And I'm sure the Hollywood good looks doesn't hurt either in this story. And he's the first guest to ever use the word Hensworth on the show. So this is already
I noticed you wrote that down. You wrote that down. So outside of having illegal drugs on you, no laws were broken.
No, I wouldn't say that.
I'm not prosecuting you here. Yeah. I sounded pretty bad. I didn't mean that that way.
You don't have licensure for that, dude.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a statute of limitation. He's pretty young. Well, you know, my motto always was, you don't get caught, it never happens. So.
Yeah, or it's not illegal if you don't get caught. Yeah, there was more than that going on. Though, you know, we weren't breaking into houses or anything like that, but there was some driving under the influence periodically and, you know, stealing money from my parents and from employers at times, mostly indirectly, which you talked about steps 8 and 9, which I'll touch on again later. But those are the amends that you don't think of at the time. Someday I may have to make amends for this, and I'm really not looking forward to that moment. But getting into recovery down the line, those were the amends where I thought, boy, I wish I would have thought twice before I pulled money out of that purse or inventory out of the closet or whatever.
I'm just glad God touched you so at a certain point you were able to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
That takes a long time, and that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So far, I am thinking that this story is going to have a miraculous change because you're using pretty steadily. You call yourself a garbage can, so you're going to try anything you can get your hands on.
Yeah.
And you're now in a position where the bottom looks like it's coming up with some help. So you're not going to – did you hit bottom?
You would think that I did pretty soon after that, but I went to college somehow. I went to a university in southern Wisconsin, and I was there for a few years, and that's when I was really digging my way to the bottom.
Okay.
So it was bad through middle school and high school, but it was not nearly what it was going to be in college. And then I dropped out of school, and then I got back in, and I dropped out again. Really, I didn't drop out. It wasn't by choice. They said, we don't actually want you to come back, So which was fair. So I was living in Whitewater in a house. I wasn't in school. I was not working. The money had run out. I was just living off overdraft from my bank account and was just kind of waiting for the end there. And a friend came from, a good friend from Indiana came up, and she said, among other things, Ted, I think you should consider going to treatment. And I didn't take that seriously, and I didn't know much about treatment. I just knew that it probably wasn't for me. So I brushed it off, and then the next day my mother came up after this friend had spoken to her, which is part of her story, which I'll let her share.
Your friend spoke to your mom?
Yeah, she did, because it was not always very clear what exactly was going on with me, and I didn't have a whole lot of staying in touch with the family, so a lot of this was behind closed doors, and my mother knew what she wanted to know or what she could know, but she didn't know everything.
So we're going to pick up the rest of the story on the other side of the break, and then we're going to bring on Mom, and Mom's going to tell her side of the story. And Ted, we only got about 20 seconds left. Do you remember a time when you thought you had, what stage of your addiction you had your mom most worried?
It was probably actually while I was in treatment.
Okay.
Strangely enough.
Right. We're going to take a little break when we come back, more with Ted's story, and then we're going to bring on Mom. Be back in just a minute. Thanks for listening to Real Recovery. Glad you're with us tonight.
I'd kind of like to, Bill, if we could have some leeway here. You're going into treatment, so you're in treatment, and at a certain point, is there a family week in treatment when the family came?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you bring me up to date, Ted, on you going to Family Week? And then I want to bring Mom in and talk about her prep for Family Week. And then I want to go back to you about what happened during Family Week. Is that fair?
Sure. Yeah.
Because we called it all the words in the Bible, if you don't go to heaven, you go to this place week, when I was in treatment. It's a Christian show, trying to get not canceled on that one. But you know what I mean? Worried about it?
Well, it's a week, I think, when everything or many things are finally out on the table. So I don't know if I was worried about it. I think maybe in some ways I was excited about it, if nothing else, just to see family members and less crazy weirdos that you see in treatment, you know. Just kidding. And
true, though.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth. I fell into that category as well, I'm sure. I wasn't well, though, right away in treatment. It took a while. I was there for about 100 days. So it wasn't as if I got in there and then, oh, Ted's different and Ted's being honest and Ted's we can see changes in him. I think there was hope for that and maybe little pieces of that happening. But for the most part, I think I was probably more sick than I was before I got in there, because now I didn't have substances. I didn't have any relief. I didn't have any escape. And it was all out there, or it was very raw. But there was no recovery. There was no relief. There was no relationship with the Lord. So it was just sickness. That wasn't, I think, it maybe as happy of a week as it could have been otherwise. Not that that's what it's about. It's to get the family on board with everything and have some transparency. But it might have been different for other people than it was for me.
How was your depression?
I mean, it was still very present, and nothing had gotten better because I hadn't given up. I was still in treatment because I wasn't to a point where they could graduate me and have any level of confidence thinking, this guy will be okay. I think they thought and communicated pretty clearly, Ted, you're not really submitting to anything. You're not really being open to any new ideas here. We don't see you practicing anything or going to 12-step meetings and sitting there and listening. I mean, I would go to the meetings they'd force us to go to, and I'd step outside and smoke a cigarette and sneak phone call a friend and tell them how painful it was to sit through these meetings and hear all this nonsense. And I was just too cool for school, or too stupid to hear anything at that point, or just too sick to be to have a moment of clarity. I just wasn't quite broken yet. But that happened at some point.
And then your mom's coming. So what are you thinking going into this?
Well, the first friends and family program we went to, my husband was on one side of Ted and I was on the other side. We were introducing ourselves. And I said, I'm Sarah. I'm here to support our son, Ted. And Ted said, my name is Ted and I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. And I thought, how is that possible? We're a family of faith. We eat dinners together. We've been to Disney World. We've taken to Washington, D.C. This doesn't happen to people like us. This isn't the way it's supposed to go. Of course, I knew why he was in treatment, but I didn't understand addiction, which is so weird because I grew up with an alcoholic father. I should have, possibly, but we didn't talk about it. So there was grief and there was relief in that moment, because I knew this was a serious thing, addiction. Obviously, there were all kinds of behavioral symptoms, but I didn't understand what the diagnosis was. And the diagnosis brought relief to me. Okay, this thing has a name. And going forward, at least we know what we're dealing with here. And I dove into educating myself about addiction and recovery and everything they gave me in those friends and family programs. I inhaled because I so wanted to know what this was all about.
And after the week, you've got something you can do. And you're all in, too, kind of like your son. This is a family trait, maybe passed down from the generation before. Did you start going to meetings for people, concerned people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the family, friends and family of alcoholics and addicts. I did, because Ted's counselor suggested that I go to that after some counseling sessions. I don't know. Maybe I was displaying some symptoms. I'm quite sure I was. And I didn't know what that was going to be about. I just went because I wanted her to think I was a good mom and I'm a rule follower and that's what you do. And I'll do anything to help Ted. So I'll show up at those meetings, whatever they are. So I did go, and after a while, I realized that those meetings were for me. They weren't for Ted. They were for me to start learning how to take care of myself and to recover from the effects of addiction and alcoholism on my own life. And it opened up a whole new world for me, and it opened up a whole new perspective of God for me, too. As I said, I was very close to God. But I feel as though in these last 8 years, my concept of God has just expanded exponentially. I feel like I kind of let him out of his cage and off his leash, and oh my goodness.
That's really interesting.
It's really interesting.
As a bystander, what I'm seeing here is that here comes a huge problem, the worst thing that has ever happened to our family. It's out of control. it's not going to end well. I want to put the brakes on it. And all of a sudden, we start seeing God, and this is the best thing that has ever happened. It increases our faith. We've got a ministry coming out because I know, you know, I know what you're doing at home, but tonight, people are hearing this going, hey, that's us. You know, we had lost all hope. I don't have any kids of my own. I have a couple stepkids now, I guess. And if something happened to them, man, I would try to do everything I could. And that's got to be just devastating. And you got to feel your own powerlessness there. You have to maybe get that for the first time. And then all of a sudden, Billy, God shows up, and this is just great.
It is. And when I've heard this expression that a parent is as happy as their saddest child. And I can only imagine, Sarah, you're trying to manage the family. You've got a marriage. You've got other kids. You have two other children. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to figure out how to manage and do life when mm-hmm. Ted is in despair.
Yeah, and I'd love to say that because I was a Christian, you know, I just motored on. But there was this element of I cannot go one more year. 5 more years, 10 more years, and watch my child spiral downward like this. I can't, I don't want to, I don't want to watch it anymore. Even though I had two other children and a wonderful husband and a charmed life by anybody's standards, I can't do this. I can't bear this sadness.
Just let that ride for a while.
You almost have to because it's so real. It's so raw.
And you try so hard to do the counseling, and I was going to youth pastors, and I was going to my own counselor and talking to other parents and experts. Is this normal? Is this normal? Because as Ted said, he did a wonderful job hiding it. So all the symptoms were there, the behavior. But what was it? Was it depression, teenage angst, the trauma of these deaths? What is the reason, and what can we do to fix it?
When you started going to support groups mm-hmm. and you found them to be very helpful, what part of that were you dealing with your own past growing up with alcoholism in your family? When did you recognize that, and when did you recognize the issues with Ted?
It's a great question. Several months into my own 12-step recovery program for friends and families of addicts, there was a lead in the meeting I was at, which is an hour long, and it was on adult children of alcoholics. And the leader of the meeting listed 10 or 12 bullet points of behavior and characteristics of children of alcoholics, and I checked them off. And I got scored 100 on that test. And I came home, and I told my husband about it, and I listed them to him, and he was like, wow, honey, you're like the poster child of adult children of alcoholics. And what was I, 50 years old at that time, and I was still practicing behaviors of an 8-year-old little girl who was just trying to survive in that family. Mm. And it was huge. It was huge because I would, through the years of an adult, especially when Ted spent that decade using, I'd say to other people, you know, here's how I'm feeling, this is what I'm doing. My mind is a gerbil wheel, and I'm practicing these things. Yeah, do you know what I mean? And they look at me and say, no, really, I don't know what you mean. Or they would just be distracted and run away. So finally, when I got into these meetings, I was sitting next to people who knew what it was like to be me, who understood what it was like to either grow up in an alcoholic home or have a child or a close family member using when you're powerless to do anything about it.
Billy, I think you could tie in on that. You know, neither one of us has any of our own kids, but we work. I was program director at the Salvation Army in Minneapolis, and Bill came down at least 2-3 nights a week. And the last year I was there, 8 of our guys died, and Bill sent me a picture today of somebody who died.
And that's the third guy in 3 months who's died.
They're not
overdose.
Your family, but the fact to me, I don't know, it's so unnecessary that it's just super sad. And when I left my position, I noticed I didn't really feel anything emotionally outside of a certain range for 2 years. And so if you had somebody that you changed their diapers, and I can't even imagine how bad that would be. Because when we lose our guys, that's devastating. And you sit back and you can't do anything. And I think the Bill in Charge shows a good 1-2 punch on a recovery. And a lot of guys get it, and these guys don't. And you realize you're totally powerless. It's all in God's hands. And everything works for good, but sometimes it's hard to see it. And that's mm-hmm. where the faith comes in. And I think Tim Keller says that God would answer our prayers exactly the way we do if we had all the information he does. Mm. But, man, it's hard for me to get there sometimes. Mm-hmm. Fair, Billy?
Totally fair. Well said, too. Well said. So, Ted, I'm curious about where you have found yourself in your own personal faith journey.
Yeah, well, it's changed over time. That's why I pause, as anybody's faith does, probably.
It's a loaded question.
It is.
It's a hard question to answer on Christian radio.
It's a good question to answer, too, though.
Our show, Ted.
Yeah. What?
Nothing.
I mean, my Christian faith and my journey through the 12 steps of recovery and other elements of my own recovery have all been mixed together, and I think have worked well together. And there's been times to figure out what that means, but it's made my Christian walk really come alive, because what I love about the 12 steps, for instance, is it, in my own experience, is a very accessible and practical way to have a relationship with the Lord, where there is, I think before recovery, I really struggled to figure out what that relationship is supposed to look like. And I wasn't willing to give things up for that relationship, as in behaviors, or mm-hmm. I wasn't willing to have a certain level of obedience. I wanted redemption or rescue when I wanted it, and then I just wanted to live my life the way I wanted to live my life. And that is not a workable relationship. And I think that's why I was banging my head against the wall. And the going through the steps and doing other things in recovery has gotten me to a place where I don't have total understanding of that relationship, but I think God honors the effort, and therefore I've been blessed with sobriety for a while because I work hard at it.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.